Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we are jumping in with part two of our great two-part episode with Dan Taylor on his recent humanitarian mission to the Middle East, specifically in Iraq, where he performed two separate and very different missions while there for about a month. He came and joined us on the Disaster Podcast just a few days after he'd gotten back, and we really appreciate him making himself available. So check out this part two of that episode. If you didn't catch part one, go back and listen to it. It's in last week's episode, and you really want to check out that first and get a good basis of what he's working on before you jump into part two. So make sure you do that. Without further ado, let's jump in and pick up with, I think, a question from Kyle Nelson for Dan about what he learned and can apply from his previous training to this humanitarian mission. Check it out.
Kyle, I didn't want to leave you out. Any thoughts or questions?
Wow, I mean, I'm just absolutely amazed. This is, been a great discussion so far. And, you know, as a fellow professional ski patroller, I just have to wonder, how did your experience, you know, kind of coming back to kind of your roots, if you will, your experience on the Big Mountain Patrol out east, how did that kind of inform your some of how you practice today?
Yeah, so I think, especially working East Coast Ski Patrol, we would get a pretty decent number of traumas, minor and major, and we would get pretty used to doing a kind of initial assessment with some limited resources with people that have, you know, multiple layers, and then needing to evacuate them to a slightly better location. So being able to provide some level of care in a resource limited environment was something I've gotten pretty comfortable with. And then I think as I've gotten further from ski patrol and some of these other opportunities I've had, I kind of go back to the basics of, you know, sick or not sick, what tools do I have? You know, what's the environment like? Can I make the environment any better? Can I move them a short distance or a little bit longer to a better environment? What does that gain us? What does that cost us? I mean, with ski patrol, often when we're transporting a patient, it's on a toboggan and we can, you know, see that they're still conscious, but we can't really do a good assessment beyond that. And if we're going to do a reassessment, we need to stop. So in terms of using non-traditional means of transportation, be it Toyota Hilux, which is a very common sort of indestructible pickup truck found throughout the Middle East, transporting and treating a patient in the back of one of those, or a box truck or some other less traditional means, being able to think about what advantages do we get by transport and what do we lose. So there are definitely some crossovers, and I'm really glad that I kind of got a fair amount of ski patrol experience. And if nothing else, it made me comfortable working out of a pretty small bag. I had a very small backpack that was my go-to for ski patrol. And I had very similar, a little bit more gear in Kurdistan, but still not a super robust kit.
So Dan, I'm wondering, you know, as you think about your second half of your mission there, maybe we could talk a little bit about that, because that was a completely different kind of setup.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll just plug one little bit of training that helped me out quite a bit. So a couple months ago, I was fortunate enough to attend a primarily Department of Defense course called the Operational Clinical Infectious Disease course through Walter Reed Army Institute of Research. And that is a tropical medicine and contagious disease course that is mostly for the Department of Defense, but they let some civilians in periodically. And so that course covered a whole range of horrific things you can get in beautiful places, but it actually covered Brucella. So I had a little bit of an understanding of what was going on thanks to that course, and that's one I highly recommend to anybody that's looking to work in some of these environments. So.
Oh, absolutely. So I can't wait to hear about the second mission, Dan.
Yeah, so the second mission. So sort of 180 degrees. So I went from teaching trauma care to providing it. So the second part, I was working in Mosul, Iraq. as of kind of the time we're recording, it's been liberated for a few hours to a day or two, depending on kind of which source you're looking at. The folks I'm still in contact with on the ground say it's only been about 12 hours or so. But Mosul was one of the last major strongholds for ISIS, especially in Iraq. Their stronghold in Syria is falling pretty rapidly as well. And there was a large push starting in October by the Iraqi army, the Peshmerga, and some coalition forces to basically retake Mosul. One of the challenges with this is that Mosul was a very heavily populated city. Some estimates were upwards of 100,000 people towards the time I was getting there. So with this, you've got an occupying force that has no problem using civilians as human shields, intentionally placing military operations in buildings with civilians, trying to reduce the number of airstrikes and so on that the coalition would carry out. And you had just a very population-dense city. So this was a real challenge for the forces that were trying to retake it. And then the part of Mosul that was being fought in when I was there is called the Old City. And as the name would imply, it's a much older part of Mosul. So you're not talking about your typical urban planning applied to a city. This has winding, narrow streets, atypical architecture. So it was something that, just from an urban warfare standpoint, was a magnitude of order harder for the troops to fight in. Plus, there's still a ton of civilians in the mix. So I was working in a trauma stabilization point, which is sort of the World Health Organization term for a small clinic that receives patients from the front and attempts to stop any major issues so that they can then be shipped off to a more traditional hospital. So I was volunteering through a group called Global Response Management. They have been running trauma stabilization points in Mosul for a while now. And we were, depending on the day, maybe a half kilometer or a little more from the active fighting. But we could, we very clearly heard every airstrike, every suicide vest that went off, every vehicle-borne IED. Some of those we even felt. They were that large or that close. And our job was to stay in the trauma stabilization point. Patients would be brought in typically by a Humvee from the Iraqi army. Patients might receive some care at the point of injury, especially some of the soldiers might get a tourniquet put on or a pressure dressing. But in a lot of these cases, we were seeing the effects of a suicide vest going off in a group of civilians. So there wasn't a lot of medical care there, and the Iraqi soldiers would do what they could. But in some cases, the best thing they could do was grab whoever looked the sickest and who looked like they were still alive, throw them in a Humvee, drive them. In some cases, 5 to 15 minutes to the trauma stabilization point. We would receive them, and we would attempt to stabilize them to the best of our ability. So often that was tourniquets, wound packing with hemostatics, chest seals, needle decompression, some limited use of advanced airways, a lot of pain management, because we had folks that, they had really disastrous combat-related injuries, some significant burns. So we would at least be able to make them comfortable, even if we weren't going to be able to fix the major problems. And then we would be sending them by ambulance, typically without a provider in the back, simply because we didn't have enough people. And then that ambulance would take them either to a coalition hospital or to one of the other hospitals that was stood up by a group like Doctors Without Borders or MSF. For some of the sickest, we would send a provider in the back of the ambulance. But on some days we had maybe four medics, up to six or eight on a good day. So if we send somebody out for what's going to be an hour or more round trip transport, that could cost other patients their lives, just because we were very routinely dealing with mass casualties, that we would get six or 10 patients over the course of just a few minutes. And without that extra person or that fourth person, we just might not get to somebody that was otherwise viable in time.
Wow. I'm sure all of us are sitting here thinking, rethinking our complaints and our everyday lives. It's just inconceivable that people have to live like that. Joe, I'm sure you got some thoughts.
Well, absolutely. I was just sitting here listening, honestly, in awe. That brucellosis case was absolutely fascinating. What a disaster-based medical mystery. I love stuff like that. So, great stuff. I'm curious to know a little bit about the sort of the conditions where you guys stayed. Can you tell us a little bit about where you were housed and sort of how that all worked?
Yeah. So briefly on the first mission, we had a small apartment that was provided in one of the major cities. So that was kind of our jumping off point. When we were working with the female unit, we were in one of the houses that survived the fighting a little bit better in that area. So kind of sporadic power, but we had a roof over our heads. The water was compromised, so we were drinking bottled water constantly. We just couldn't drink the local. The second group that we were training, we were on a forward operating base. So we were in effectively a Connex box, kind of like a metal shipping container, what is sort of what it looked like. We had a fan in that. We also had a really nice hole in the ceiling that was covered by a blue tarp, and that hole was from a mortar that had hit just over where I was sleeping a couple weeks before we got there. And then in Mosul, we had the organization had secured two different locations for us to sleep at. So the one I was primarily at was or had been a mosque. It was now being used. The main worship space was being used as a casualty collection point. So when the front was a little bit closer to that mosque, that was their kind of primary trauma stabilization point. Now it was sort of a secondary location. And then we had two other structures on that same property that were one, I believe, was more of kind of a space for the religious leader, and the other one was a smaller worship space. We had reasonable, maybe 2-3 inch thick mats that were put on the floor. The smaller space, I think there were six folks, co-ed, sharing that space. The other one where I was sleeping, we had maybe 10 individuals. And so we would be sleeping there. We had the ability to boil water. We had a little bit of running water so we could rinse off. But the shower, as we would think about it in the West, didn't really exist there. It was a faucet next to a squatting toilet with maybe 5 foot bit of hose that came off the faucet. So you would basically squat down and kind of rinse yourself off the best you could. So those were kind of our accommodations. And the nice thing about sleeping at the mosque was that it was the location that overnight casualties would be brought to, especially the Iraqi Special Operations Forces. So we had one night where we had two MCIs that were brought in, and basically we kind of got out of our bunks and headed over and worked them, and then went back to bed. And we didn't have much of a commute to work that night, so it was pretty convenient. And then the other space in Mosul was a fairly good-sized house, maybe three floors, that housed a number of Iraqi Special Operations Forces, maybe 30 to 40 guys, plus six or so medics, depending on the day. And that was also a very small casualty collection point that was largely to house the troops. But we were co-located with them, so we had 24/7 security. It also improved the flow of intelligence so that if there was kind of a new threat of some sort, which periodically there were, we would be kind of the first or second people to know, because the guys that were going to be dealing with that threat were sleeping right next to us.
So, Dan, I was going to say, Dan, I had a question about, you know, what about the care of you and your team? We talk about this quite a bit, is, you know, the disaster responders or people responding in austere environments, you know, have to take care of themselves, not just the people that they are there to care for. So were there any challenges that you dealt with regards to that?
So I think time will certainly tell on some of that. I think especially for me, I mean, I saw some pretty horrific things. And I know just personally that I process in kind of a more of a delayed manner. I think like a lot of us, I compartmentalize. And then in time, I will unpack some of those things. But overall, I mean, just the basic medical care, we knew that if something bad had happened, for example, if our vehicle rolled over and we were severely injured, we were going to be on our own. We were going to be self-sufficient and probably transporting ourselves. I mean, I have some unofficial connections in the area through some friends I've networked with that work for a few different groups that expressed, hey, if something really bad does happen, give me a shout. We'll get some help out to you. So that was certainly reassuring, but it's not the same thing as calling 911 and having professional help arrive pretty quickly. So we definitely had some basic antibiotics for ourselves, things that were prescribed to us individually in the United States should we develop, for example, a waterborne illness that required antibiotics, which, as a side note, most traveler's diarrhea does not need to be treated with antibiotics. People are too aggressive with that. And then we had basic trauma gear. I had a fair amount of trauma supplies because I was planning on going to Mosul. And then we had some very kind of minor, you know, Band-Aids, moleskin, water hydration or water purification tablets, some of the things along those lines, so that we were able to take care of ourselves on a kind of basic day-to-day basis. We certainly checked in with each other, you know, hey, you know, when was the last time you had something to drink? How's the food sitting with you? Still not well. Okay, good to know. Here's some more loperamide. So, you know, basic stuff like that. And then since coming home, we've all been in contact. You know, one of my teammates I've been kind of texting with a couple times a day since I got back. We had a video conference earlier this evening, mostly talking about organizational stuff, but also kind of seeing where everybody was at. So, you know, basic healthcare, largely we were on our own. We did some planning to figure out where we would be going if there was a problem. Beyond that, not a lot of sophisticated care available for us.
Sound familiar, Joe?
Yes, it does. It's interesting. The commonalities, no matter where you are in the world, is just amazing.
Well, Kyle, I bet you've got a lot of questions in your head.
Man, lots of thoughts, lots of questions. I do like definitely referring to the piece on, you know, making sure that, you know, yourselves and your team is taken care of as well. And not just, you know, with the physical supplies that you bring, but also with the camaraderie that you bring and the mental and emotional support, because that's definitely a huge part of what all of us here do as medical providers. And just making sure that, you know, not just that we're, you know, taking care of, you know, our patients and those that come to us for assistance, but that we're also focusing on ourselves as well. And so, I mean, is that one of the things that you do, is kind of go through those types of, you know, like critical stress debriefings and things? Is it so formalized, or is it more kind of informal for your team, would you say?
It's definitely more on the informal side. I mean, I have formal CISM, CISD training. I've been on a team that's done that. So I certainly understand the framework, and I understand some of the research pro and con on that approach. But for both the groups, the group I worked with in Mosul and the group I worked with in Kurdistan, we're smaller organizations. We don't really have the infrastructure to support, you know, a CISM team or having a therapist on call. It's definitely informal. but there is still kind of an intentional aspect to that informalness that, you know, we knew going into this, both missions, that there were going to be a number of challenges, and we kind of prepared ourselves to the best of our ability, but we also knew that we were going to be reliant on each other to a certain degree because our partners at home didn't see the same things that we did. And we can certainly, and we do, share with our partners and allow them to kind of understand where we're at, but it's a different perspective. So I think we, especially the teammates that I worked with in Mosul, I very intentionally kind of reached out. Some of them are still on the ground. Some of them are back in the U.S. now, trying to get a sense of, hey, you know, what's normal for you? Are you back to your normal? And in being honest, I mean, yesterday I had kind of a down day. It was one of my first full days back at home, and it was a big adjustment going from the hustle and bustle, the constant drive, the very clear sense of purpose day in and day out that I had in Kurdistan and had in Mosul, to coming home and being able to relax, whatever that looks like. And I was honest with one of my teammates about that, and we talked about it, and you know, and we kind of employed a little bit better coping mechanisms. We both worked out, and so, yeah, it's definitely an informal process, but it's something that we're all pretty aware of. I suspect all of us have lost friends to suicide and have seen the effects of kind of coping, you know, via alcohol and other substances. And I think none of us really want to go through that again. So we try to, you know, be pretty honest, brutally honest about the things that we experienced and the toll that that may take on us.
Yeah, I pretty much equate this with what we've talked with Joe about, because that's part of his responsibility as a team doc to do team self-care. But when you have a smaller team like that, you're much more likely to notice problems within the team and be able to help people out. So it's pretty critical you have that in place. Dan, what are kind of the takeaways for you? What in both of these missions, what did you bring home with you that was either new or profound or makes you want to go back and do it again?
Well, I definitely want to go back on both missions. The very strong sense of we were actually able to make a difference, especially in Kurdistan. We were able to employ more of a train-the-trainer model with especially the six guys that we worked with, so that I saw some of the things we've done in the U.S. training-wise definitely worked there, and we tried to set them up for success going forward so that they can continue training even when we're not present and they don't have our direct support. And in terms of Mosul, I think I was incredibly surprised that the basics are good. The basics work. The things that I've learned and done on the ambulance and in other settings, and the things I've been teaching when I teach tactical emergency casualty care and active shooter response, they're solid. Tourniquets work. Wound packing works. You know, the basics of trauma care that really make a difference are profoundly impactful. And we had patients that, you know, I know some of them weren't going to survive no matter what, but I know there were a few that only survived because of the critical interventions that we performed. And I think it was really reassuring when so many parts of medicine shift, or we say, hey, this thing we were doing wasn't as good as we thought, or in fact was harmful, that I can look at something like the TCCC standard and say, you know, wow, that really works. That really makes a difference. And those trauma lessons transfer into civilian life as well. So I think both of those, being able to set the group in Kurdistan up for continued success without us, was really positive. And then just coming back to the core trauma things that we've learned over, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, those make a huge difference, and I'm even more excited to bring that to my students, and I'll be teaching in a little over a week in New York State, and you can bet that they're going to be hearing about some of this stuff too.
Wow, I can imagine. Well, none of us will disagree with what you're saying, and Joe teaches very much the same thing. So you kind of touched on it, but what else is in the future for you?
So I'm doing quite a bit of teaching. I'll be teaching at the State Preparedness Training Center in New York State. I think I'm doing about 3 weeks over the next 4 or so weeks. And then a few more courses in the fall. We're doing a rescue task force course and some more active shooter response and some other training for law enforcement EMS. There's some talk of maybe some more TV work later in the fall, so we'll see if anything comes of that. And then I'm hoping to do a little bit more of the humanitarian work, probably January, February, maybe somewhere in that time. So, you know, a lot of teaching in the future for me. Also looking at working on an international paramedic cert to increase some of my job opportunities in the oil and gas and international field.
Excellent, excellent.
Wow, you do not have a boring life.
No, he doesn't. Definitely. You know, Joe, I was thinking a lot about, you know, you and what you guys do at Paragon Medical Education Group, you know, with the specialized type of tactical training and things that you provide for things like active shooters and things like that. And just hearing what Dan said about, you know, the importance and the effectiveness of things like tourniquet application and wound packing and things that we've discussed on this show many times in the past.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's always good to hear that the approach you've been taking has been field tested and continues to get the job done and work in the real world. And obviously that's one of the things we've really been focused on for a long time, is trying to stay up to date with real world practices, so that the stuff that we're teaching people has credibility and we know works.
So if people want to bring Paragon in to provide training in their region to try to bring some of that real world application training to them, how can they reach out to you? Where can they find you?
Well, they can find us on the web at ParagonMedicalEducationGroup.com. We have a Facebook page by the same name. They can certainly reach us through the Disaster Podcast, or hopefully the Disaster Podcast Facebook page as well.
Excellent. And thanks again for your continued support of the show. Daniel, where is there a way that people can reach out to you if they want to find out a little bit more about whether this is something they might want to do in the future?
Yeah, sure. I'm on Twitter and Instagram quite a bit. Frozen Medical on both of those. They can shoot me an email at dan@frozenmedical.com. And I'm happy to correspond. And I've got some pictures, especially from the Mosul trip, up on Instagram right now. And some of my teammates have been posting as well. So from there, and I'm friends with you, Jamie, on Facebook. I've got some additional pictures up there, too. So all those platforms work, and I'm certainly happy to talk with people about this and connect them to other individuals who can help them get out and do some of this work. There's a huge need, and we need really more skilled medical providers going into these environments.
Excellent. And you'll have to maybe select a couple of photos that I can put on the post for this episode, these two episodes that we recorded here.
Absolutely.
So if you could just, you know, pick two good pictures and send them to me, that would be great.
Happy to do so.
Excellent. Kyle, where can folks find you?
Well, Jamie, folks can find me on all the social media places under the handle WX Kyle Nelson. So feel free to connect with me online and continue the conversation.
Excellent, excellent. And Sam, you're still sitting there in the shade, I guess, out there in Nevada. When you're back in Colorado, how can people reach out to you?
Well, actually, you can reach me no matter where I am on the usual social media sites under Sam Bradley and Brad7, certainly on the DisasterPodcast.com website and our Facebook page. So, Dan, that would be if you haven't done that, that would be great to have you over there, because I can imagine there's a lot of people out there who would be interested in doing this kind of medicine but don't really know where to start. So they might be able to shoot some questions to you.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Sounds good.
Yeah, definitely look that up. And for all of you out there, if you want to join the Facebook group, just search for Disaster Podcast on Facebook, and you'll find our Facebook group. Just request to join, and one of us will let you in, and you can join the conversation there and ask questions of Dan or any of our experts that we've had on the show. Many of them are part of the group now. And I'm going to go ahead and wrap things up. We're having a little problem with Sam's cell phone right now. So we're going to go ahead and close out this episode. And I think this episode really is a great reminder of everything we've really thought about with regard to austere medicine and dealing with austere environments. I don't think you can get much more austere than some of the things Daniel was dealing with. And I think we'll just close it out and leave it with that and say, disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.